Welcome back to the Innovation Forum podcast with this episode for Friday, 2nd of November with me, Ian Welsh. Coming up is our usual digest of news and comment. Plus, when Innovation Forum was in London a couple of weeks ago, my colleague Toby Webb spoke with Lula Young, Baroness Young of Hornsey, about what companies need to do to tackle the developing frustrations around progress on business, human rights and modern slavery. And when we were in Amsterdam at Innovation Forum's conference on business and plastics pollution, I talked with Felix Gummer, director at Sancroft, about positive trends in how business is getting to grips with the environmental impacts of plastics. Before that, though, our weekly review of some of what's happening in business and sustainability. This week's Living Planet Report 2018 from WWF is further evidence of the need for business to take immediate action to deal with planetary impacts and for those with agricultural commodities in their value chains to secure long-term sustainable sources of supply. The report shows the drastic decline in biodiversity in the past few decades, with an average 60% drop in populations of mammals, birds, fish, reptiles and amphibians in the past 40 years. WWF concludes that the biggest drivers of biodiversity loss are overexploitation in agriculture, linked to increasing human consumption. With a nod to the recent Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's report calling for action to limit global warming to a maximum of 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial times, WWF also points out the inherent connectivity between biodiversity, climate, and the general health of our home planet. All is not yet lost, and the Living Planet report is wise to provide examples of the sorts of protection and rehabilitation programmes that have demonstrated that the tanker can be turned around. In financial terms, we simply have to find an effective way of truly valuing the $125 trillion of services that nature provides towards the planet's health and wealth. There are signs that pennies are dropping. That PM, the BBC's flagship radio evening news programme, led this week with a report on the impacts on biodiversity from soy farming in the Brazilian Cerrado grasslands is surely an indication of growing wider awareness of the sorts of issues that have, until now, been the preserve of environmentalists and experts at a few leading companies. Governments may be forced to do more. In mid-October, the Court of Appeal in the Netherlands ordered the Dutch government to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 25% by 2020. An action had been raised by the Urgenda Foundation on the basis that, by failing to act effectively to deal with climate change, the Netherlands government had failed to abide by the European Convention on Human Rights, notably the right to life and the right to a private and family life. The court found that climate change is sufficiently dangerous and severe to impose on the state a duty of care to act. This may be a trend to watch. Paralleling climate change as a great challenge of our times and arguably getting more specific attention is, of course, plastic pollution. The UK budget speech from Finance Minister Philip Hammond this week, for example, had not one mention of climate change or the IPCC report, but announced several initiatives on plastics, including a taxing of some less sustainable repackaging from 2023. And this week's launch of the new Plastics Economy Global Commitment by the Ellen MacArthur Foundation and the UN Environment Programme aims to tackle the upstream plastics problem by eliminating single-use packaging materials, increasing the amount of used or recycled materials in new products, and sparking continued innovation to ensure that 100% of plastic packaging can be either reused, recycled or composted by 2025. Governments, financial institutions and companies are all involved. Initial signatories account for 20% of all plastic packaging produced globally. An important point is that the targets the commitment sets will be continually reviewed, with participants required to report annual progress data. Hopefully, this necessary rigour will not dissuade non-signatories from signing up in the future to this solutions-focused initiative. How companies can most effectively report on their activities and impacts from operations and supply chains is, of course, an ongoing issue, with a proliferation of standards, guidance and protocols. Some good news then, if the standard setters follow the urging of a paper from the Global Investor Organisations Committee for reporting standing setters to do more to agree an approach to the treatment and inclusion of environmental, social and governance data in corporate disclosure and reporting. The investors support improving coordination of existing frameworks rather than creating new ones, and that it is incumbent on the standard-setting organisations to create a coherent vision of how these standards, such as the Global Reporting Initiative, the Climate Disclosure Standards Board, and Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, can and should fit together. A call no doubt echoing the thoughts of many corporate sustainability and communications executives around the world. Rounding off our autumn conference series, Innovation Forum will be in London on Tuesday and Wednesday next week for our marquee Sustainable Landscapes Conference, with 250 plus delegates and four distinct tracks across the 2 days, covering land, forests, farmers, and technology and innovation. We've got practically a full house, but if you want to join us, we'll be happy to squeeze you in. Details on the Innovation Forum website and newsletter. And we're working hard on our spring conference programme, which will include new events on the future for food, apparel, supply chains, modern slavery, climate change, and the developing bioeconomy. Full details will be launched shortly online and in the podcast. Interview time now. At Innovation Forum's Business, Human Rights and Modern Slavery event in London last week, Toby Webb spoke with Baroness Young of Hornsey.
You've very kindly given up some of your time to come and talk to our audience here and engage in dialogue about modern slavery and human rights. We just had our opening session, which was under the Chatham House rule. But how would you describe the last hour or so in your own words, Lola? What do you think we've been discussing and what's your takeaway?
I would say there's an air of frustration about now. Okay, so we've had the Modern Slavery Act since 2015 and transparency in supply chains is a very important part of that. And we've been talking about it. You know, my colleagues on the panel, colleagues in the audience, I'm sure have also heard quite a lot about it. And I think we're now getting to the level where, okay, we've had this preliminary discussion. What is it? How can we do it? Why should we be doing it? But the thing is, how are we going to stop? How are we going to eliminate, or at least work towards eliminating modern forms of slavery from supply chains? We haven't got the answers yet. We've got some solutions, but I think there's a general feeling, this might be my bias, my general feeling, maybe I should say, is that government needs to do more, businesses need to do more, investors could be a bit more active, and maybe some consumers could do a little bit too. But whatever it is, you know, we haven't got to a stage where we have the same kind of traction as environmental issues, particularly if you think about plastic, as somebody said, you know, the whole plastics thing, everybody's into their drinking bottles and not using plastic bottles and all the rest of it, and how you can upcycle all of that. We need that kind of momentum to develop very, very quickly in this area.
So given the work you do in the House of Lords, you know, raising awareness for this, what's the sort of average reaction from people who haven't heard of this? Because you'd have thought things like palm oil, we're all agreed we want it to be sustainable. Mm. Plastics, we're all agreed we want them to be sustainable. Nobody wants modern slavery.
Nobody wants modern slavery.
Surely it should be as easy, not that they're easy wins, but there should be the same level of interest.
Well, could I do a little bit of history here? And I think this is part of the problem, interestingly enough. So when people think of slavery, they think of the transatlantic slave trade, even though there have been different models of slavery since humans have learned how to enslave people, so for almost forever. And so that there was a feeling that there was a line drawn under the whole concept of slavery in the 19th century. If you come to, let's say, 2009, where I passed my first amendment in the House of Lords, which was to criminalise forced labour and domestic servitude. And at that stage, in 2009, people were saying to me, but isn't it already a criminal offence?
I'm astounded that it wasn't.
It wasn't. It wasn't at all. And the then Labour government were very resistant initially.
Why?
To putting... Well, because they claimed false imprisonment was a way of getting this. So there's civil torts around the area. Mm. There wasn't any criminal law around it. So people started to come to me. I met some victims. I met some people who worked with victims. And this was on a relatively small scale, because we were talking about in that domestic setting a lot of the time. And he thought, how can this be going on next door to me, maybe, or somebody else? So that at that stage, parliamentarians were saying, what's this about? Never heard of this. What's going on? I think it was Aidan from Anti-Slavery International said it's a historical anomaly, because enslavement was never formally or legally allowed on British soil, people didn't think to legislate against it.
I see. Okay.
So now we're trying to write that, mm-hmm. but also looking at it in that global sense. So if you fast forward from 2009 to 2018, that's 9 years. many, many, many more people are much more aware of it. Okay, levels are still too low, but many, many people are much more aware of the kinds of things that can happen. So now that we know, we can't unknow that, and we've got to do something really decisive about it.
How would you like to see the Modern Slavery Act moving forward in terms of awareness and enforcement? And we've just had a session where we're kind of bemoaning government inactivity. At the moment, we don't have a Modern Slavery Commission. What are the chances of further activity in the coming years? And if the UK government is distracted by Brexit and by its sort of own ineptitude, shall we say, what are the other rays of light in terms of other governments that you think about? So UK first and then perhaps some other governments.
Yes, sure. So my feeling is it's part of my job to harass government. And so when I look at Section 54, we passed that legislation very quickly because an election was imminent and therefore we had to do it or abandon it. And so I think most people felt, well, as flawed as the Act is, it's better to have it than not. So we passed it. And I think at the time I tried to introduce an amendment straight away, which was to include public bodies in Section 54. Billions and billions of pounds worth of contracts are given out. At the moment, government departments give contracts out to companies who aren't even legally compliant with Section 54. There's a hell of a lot of work to be done there. So I think, yes, harassing government is really, really important. In terms of how we might move forward, especially thinking about how we can collaborate internationally, lots of us, particularly through the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association, I meant to mention that earlier, because they're doing a really good job of saying to all those Commonwealth countries, many of whom are, as it were, the suppliers of modern slaves and exploited labour, to say to them, look, this is happening in your backyard. It's also happening that this country X is exporting, as it were, these people to work in these conditions. You also have to do something in a legislative context. So we've been through the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association running workshops with different jurisdictions. My little fantasy, if you like, tells you how sad I am. A little fantasy is that in maybe 3 to 5 years, we would have a very big international conference which brings together, or symposium, which brings together businesses. It brings the good, the bad and the ugly in respect of this. It brings together different parliamentarians from various jurisdictions to say what they've been doing and how we can make it work better on a global scale. Because I think if we can produce what is effectively a legislative ring of fire, and there's no hiding place for either the businesses or the traffickers, then we might actually get somewhere. It feels like we've got quite a long way to go before we're ready to do that.
Yes.
And I'm not sure that there's even a precedent about it. But certainly I would point to issues around the environment. You know,
well, I mean, all sorts of treaties around chemicals, ozone, Montreal Protocol.
You know, there sexual is violence and conflict, all of those kinds of areas.
There's serious precedent here, I don't see why it can't be done.
No, but in this subject, it's not been done, I guess. And that is a challenge, particularly as we did have that discussion this morning about human rights or modern slavery. I mean, how do we frame the question even? And I think that needs to be discussed. We need to be quite open about that. So, for example, Caribbean countries don't want to talk to you about modern slavery because they're still reeling from the impact of the transatlantic slave trade and looking for reparations. So you have to use a different kind of language and a different kind of way in to getting them to think about what they've got to deal with. With the Indian subcontinent, that term slavery doesn't have any kind of purchase at all. So people talk much more about abusive labour, trafficking, etc. In some of the sub-Saharan African countries, there's a fear that it's almost that the West is trying to stop us developing economically by coming down hard on our practices like traditional use of children and so on and so forth. So we have to be very sophisticated and nuanced in the way we address these issues and the way they manifest themselves. The UN recognises child marriage as a form of enslavement, which essentially it is. So how do you change those, what people see as traditional practices that have led to that? You know, we've got a huge job on our hands.
Well, we'd be happy to work with you on creating such a conference.
Fantastic.
It's what we do. I mean, we're more business orientated, but, we need to broaden it, particularly in this subject. Yeah. One final question for you. The B word, Brexit.
Oh, gosh.
I was listening to Farming Today the other day on Radio 4, and they were talking about 2,500 trial visas being issued for agricultural workers coming in from outside the EU. And I envisioned all these Brexiteers who hated all these European migrants suddenly falling in love with these other migrants who come in, and they didn't seem likely to happen to me. Is Brexit going to be a good thing or a bad thing for Modern Slavery? Because I can see some big scandals happening.
Oh, it could be a disaster. And let me be clear, I'm not in favour of Brexit, but this is where we are. Or where are we? I don't know. Anyway,
we're not quite sure where we are.
It's interesting, just coming back from Brussels, because it's flooded with British people at the moment, all trying to work out where we are. But I think there are two or more threats around Brexit. One is what you've just mentioned, is if you get these people in, are we going to be making sure that they're paid properly, et cetera, and good working conditions? We know that agriculture, for example, is a really high risk in terms of modern slavery, and we've seen instances, cases have come to court around that sector. So again, we come back to the question of how is it going to be policed and monitored that people are being treated correctly. Mm-hmm. The other fear that is very real and present is that what gains we have made may be destroyed by the desire and compulsion to create trade deals with countries that actually will say, we're not very interested in human rights, actually, but we'll do a trade deal with you if you cut that bit out about modern slavery and human rights.
Yeah.
So we're in danger, I think, of losing what gains we have made. The trouble is that there's so many different places where we need to focus energy, and there's not enough of us to go around.
Yes.
So any solutions you've got to that innovative forum? Tell us.
People's vote on Brexit.
Yeah.
Let's just do that and stop this silly nonsense. That'll give us a bit more resources to focus on what's really important.
Yeah.
That's all I've got.
We'll talk about that forever.
Do another 2 hours on Brexit.
We'll
draw this to a close. Lola, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure, Toby.
And for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you.
When I was in Amsterdam recently, I sat down with Felix Gummer, director of Sancroft, and we debated trends in how business is tackling plastic pollution. We've just been talking in conference around how society is expecting the end of single-use plastics, yes or no, or is this possible, and you know, the kind of time frame for this potentially. So what are the trends that you're seeing from your work with industry associations and brands and plastics? Where's everything going?
Well, the first thing is total engagement. And I think that 2-3 years ago, there were some people who'd say that it was vaguely understood about recyclability. But then as soon as they started scratching the surface, it was all too complicated. And actually, they wanted to get back to first principles of packaging, which was about look and feel, product protection, presentation, and usability by the consumer. All of which it performs extremely well. But what has really changed is people's willingness and appetite to engage fully and actually really, really engage with the complex issues and not just say too hard to do at this stage.
So that's the trend. So basically, people are now engaging on the problem. Is that because consumers have got hold of it as a big issue?
Well, what we've seen is a complete confluence of, especially in the UK, but across the world, is a confluence of a whole series of different issues. The first of which is, of course, the environmental side of it. Secondly, governments who are looking at increasing legislation. And thirdly, the media and NGO and activist activity in this area, which has made it completely mainstream. I mean, I have to say that the ocean plastics scheme is not entirely new. I remember seeing a documentary on this subject about 6-7 years ago on the BBC, probably by the same production unit that did Planet Earth. But first of all, it wasn't Mr. Attenborough, and it wasn't in the same time as all of these other events were going on as well. So it has taken this perfect storm for it to come to the fore.
Yes, it does feel that Blue Planet really did change the scene, really, in terms of consumer engagement. So what other drivers, then, of innovation in this area?
If you look at legislation, there are certain elements of this area which are going to be more expensive in the future than they are now. And as a result of that, packaging, which is a tiny proportion of the overall product cost, usually, is actually going to become more of a factor within the product decision. And also the variances of the cost between different options around recyclability and collection is actually going to be more of a consideration. And people are going to have to start engaging with what polymer they're going to use, for example. Before, it was just done purely on the function and usability and all the rest of it.
This is something we talked about in the session. I mean, you were saying that an ideal future we'd have, we get back down to say two polymers, a hard plastic polymer and a soft plastic polymer. But then others have been saying in our session that you've got to look at the variety of jobs that plastic does, and it's very hard to find all those jobs done by a fewer number of polymers. How do we see through this? How do we get to the stage where we are reducing the number of polymers that are out there, which then makes it easier to recycle and to reuse the products?
Well, the first thing is you put the tension into the system, which enables people to choose the right polymer for the job and the most sustainable one, unless there is an absolute outstanding reason for it. So the classic is yogurt pots. Why are we using polystyrene yogurt pots when we could be using PE yogurt pots, which are recyclable? The reason is because there is a marginal cost benefit to using PS pots. And if the system actually shifted overnight, people would then shift to using the PE pots.
Think of it in terms of legislation. You mentioned it just now. What's the sort of legislation that works well in this area?
The legislation that works well is usually the one that doesn't get too into the trying to micromanage the situation, but enabling business to come up with a solution to reach the end. So the legislation shouldn't be around banning plastic. The legislation should be ensuring that product is protected and no plastic enters the environment, because that would then create the right behaviour. Now, in the future, plastic could become the Bakelite of yesteryear. But at the moment, it is the only material that protects food in the way that it does, actually with the lightest carbon footprint in many operations. However, the benefit that it produces has also hidden its misuse in other areas and unnecessary proliferation of its types across the board.
Where do you sit in the whole debate around food wastage versus use of different non-plastic products debate? That's one that we've had already this morning. Is there not a real danger that if companies go down a fully non-plastics route, then we're suddenly going to have a massive food wastage problem on our hands?
Well, I'm outcomes orientated, and for me, primarily food waste is the most important element in this. And that actually, we live in a world where we have, with current technology, about 60 harvests left to feed our current population and projected population. I mean, this is extremely worrying. So therefore, anything that reduces our ability to produce food is therefore causing the deaths of many people across the planet. But that shouldn't be at the expense of the environment, which also in of itself would reduce the amount of food that can be produced. I mean, if you're going to look at it at a purely on human selfish level, polluting the oceans is not in our interest. And therefore, using something that's nominally protecting our food today, which is actually endangering our food in the future, is nonsensical, therefore. And we're talking about very short time spans. So you need to find the best item that protects the food so that we can continue to feed the world's population, but then do it in a way which doesn't jeopardize the environment at the same time.
For companies then, what are the best sort of targets to set in this area?
Well, the very first one is recyclability. The reason I say that is because it's easy and it's something that businesses can do straight away. Look at the products that you're putting on the market. Are they recyclable? If they're not recyclable, why not? And do they need to remain to be recyclable, or is it an item that you can get rid of? Usually people are putting their products into three broad categories. The first of which is unnecessary packaging, which you can just get rid of. The second one is packaging that either is or should be recyclable, and therefore you make sure that everything in that category is and should be recyclable. And then the third category is items which, for whatever reason, is not recyclable currently, but then you actively pursue mechanisms and technologies to ensure that that solution is found in the future. But you can then at least get your hands around the items which are not recyclable for whatever reason. Once you've made it recyclable, is to take ownership of that packaging and make sure that it is recycled. It's not enough just to say it's recyclable, it's now up to the local authority. Because first of all, you will undermine your work if it's not being recycled. And then also what you'll find is that something that you deem to be recycled, if it's not being recycled, you'll still have just all the same problems with it further down the road.
It strikes me that the big issue is consumers still don't really see the value in the plastic product. They still think of it as something that they use it and then it can be thrown away. But all that we're talking about relies on consumers to really engage and to recycle and to reuse and to collect and put into whatever deposit scheme or whatever scheme of waste collection we have. But it relies on the consumer to do it. How can we get the consumer to really do that properly, to really push on to the sorts of levels of recycling that will really solve the problem?
The two main ways of doing that is simplicity and ease. We have a fundamental problem with the current system, that the hardest part of the cycle is owned by the least engaged and least educated and least willing section of that cycle. We were listening to one of the retailers talking here today, and actually not even one of the largest ranges, but it's 60,000 SKUs which they are doing. Consumers, first of all, having to choose from those products, then with the multiplicity of packaging that comes out of that, deciding where to put it. You can make it as simple as possible for them, provide the infrastructure so that they don't need to go out of their way to recycle it, so it's as easy for them as possible, then you will engage them. And then you can start encouraging, and if after that, you can then look at enforcement.
Let's throw things forward a bit. I mean, as you said right at the start, this is something that's become a massive great issue just very recently. What do you think is going to happen in the next 2 years? What do you think real innovation is going to be? And what do you hope to see from companies around plastics?
Well, I think there are three main areas which are going to be really exciting. Just to keep it tight, let's talk about continuing with plastics, because at the moment we're not seeing any technologies emerging which do exactly the same task across the board. But for existing plastics would be technologies which are better at single polymers that do more jobs so that you can have that rationalization. The second one is having sorting processes so that you can actually make sure that you have 100% of items going into the relevant area. And the third one, of course, is the recycling process, which means that you eliminate waste from the recycling process. Those are three innovations. What do you get out of that? It's not only to have 100% recyclable items, but 100% recycled. That's the important area where people can then take ownership of it and track their material through and actually making sure that it is fully recycled and it's not wasted through the process.
That comes back again to engaging the consumer and making them want to get the product back into the loop. Is that then when a deposit return scheme is going to work?
The deposit return scheme, for me, is a very difficult one. At the moment, deposit return, it works on a few items, but it's targeting the few items which are already recycled at the very highest level. So drinks containers, drinks bottles in the UK are recycled at 74%. Cans and glass bottles at around 70%. Plastic film is recycled in the mid single figures of percentage. If you were looking at this afresh, you would say, which items would you be targeting? Not targeting the ones that if you were to go from 74% to 100%, you would only increase recycling rates in the UK by about 5% overall as a result of what it does. We put as many films by weight on the market as we do drinks bottles. And therefore, as far as plastic goes, we really should be targeting that. Deposit return schemes are extremely expensive. And the other problem with it is you are telling effectively 3/4 of the population who are currently already doing the right thing. You are saying, I'm now going to make it more difficult for you to recycle than you currently are. One of the things that we were discussing today is that we always on a knife edge with taking people with us. And if you make it more difficult for people to do the right thing than to do the wrong thing, which is what deposit return does, or make it more difficult for them to do the right thing in the future than they are to do the right thing now, you risk losing huge swathes of the population to do it. Now, I know it's very popular amongst some people in the activists, and a lot of people haven't engaged with it. But what you'll find is that when you introduce a new system like that, you say, well, I want to put it in my bin outside the front of my house, and I've always done that, and I've absolutely always done it. I now have to collect this up along with my carrier bags, along with everything else, and then take it back to the supermarket, sit there and put it through a machine. Mm-hmm. You're going to find that there's a lot of lost goodwill in an environment where people are willing to do huge amounts where they weren't before.
Yeah. So I guess the point is, unless they take it back to get the deposit back, if they simply put it into their recycling box outside their house, then they're not going to get the 5p, whatever it is per
bottle. Well, I mean, if it's 5p, people won't do it.
Yeah.
So, and if it's 20p, 50p a pound, then they have to make a material convenience choice as to whether or not they do that. But then you'll also get, which is what you see in every other country with the deposit return system, which is that people then start rifling through the bins to collect it for the money. That's bad enough in bins in the street. But this would be the first time in Europe where we have a deposit return system with curbside collections. And people will then be, you know, we'll have someone rifling through the bin in your front garden. So there are a lot of unintended consequences about it. For me, DRS is a misdirection of resources. I have run a reverse vending operation in the UK, and it's completely counter to the way that the system works at the moment. And as I say, it's targeting the wrong bit of the process.
Sure. Well, there's lots of different solutions around there, lots of engagement and lots of passion running high. But for now, Felix Gummer from Sancroft, thank you very much indeed. Don't forget, next week we'll be debating business and sustainable landscapes in London on the 6th and 7th of November. But that's it for now. I've been Ian Welsh. We'll be back next week. And until then, goodbye.